Case number 13-5118, Raimundo Zacarias Mendoza et al. Appellants, Alfredo Cono Delca, Metamorphosis versus Thomas E. Perez in his official capacity as Secretary of the United States Department of Labor et al. Ms. Murray for the appellants, Mr. Defoe for the appellees, Mr. Swan for the interveners.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Julie Murray, Counsel for Plaintiffs' Appellants. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. May it please the Court, the plaintiffs in this case are precisely the kind of U.S. workers that Congress sought to protect from the potential adverse effect of the importation of foreign labor through the H-2A visa program. The plaintiffs filed this case to challenge DOL rules adopted without notice and comment that determine how little sheep and cattle herders can be paid, what kinds of workplace protections those workers are entitled to, and whether herders have access to the most basic housing accommodations, such as electricity and toilets. I'd like to begin by talking about the nature of plaintiff's injury, which I think is at the core of the district court's dismissal below. The primary injury that the plaintiffs have set forth is that the TEAGLs, the DOL rules in this case, set wages and working conditions below those required by the INA's certification mandate. As a result, the TEAGLs reduced the availability of wages and working conditions for U.S. workers like my clients at statutorily required wages and working conditions.
Can I ask you a quick question? Are you challenging simply the differential of what changed in the 2011 TEAGL between what had come before, or the 2011 TEAGL as sort of the re-embodiment, re-adoption of all the exceptions that had come before?
Certainly the latter, Your Honor. It's our position that all of these special procedures that DOL has adopted over the years have been unlawful and that they have all been substantive in nature and have not undergone notice and comment rulemaking. So we're not challenging the switch, although there are some changes between the earlier sets of special procedures and the current TEAGLs. We're just challenging the adoption wholesale in 2011 of the current TEAGLs, which, as we say in our brief, exempt herders from important...
Are those changes substantive?
They are, Your Honor. For example, if you compare the current TEAGLs to the 1989 and 2001 special procedures for sheep herders, for example, the earlier sets of special procedures provided that employers would pay either a prevailing wage or a special adverse effect wage rate that could be established by the department. If you look at the 2011 TEAGLs for sheep herders, of course, the department has jettisoned the possibility of the adoption of a special AWOR altogether and requires only payment of a prevailing wage. If you look at the 2007 special procedures as well, those did not talk about frequency of pay. Of course, if you look at the current TEAGLs, workers can be paid, herders can be paid once a month by agreement of the worker, which is not something that regular H-2A workers can
waive. Can I clarify one thing? When you talk about the current TEAGLs, and it sounds to me like you're saying plural, is that more than the 2011 one or the two in 2011?
The two in 2011, yes, that's right, Your Honor, because there's one TEAGL for sheep and goat herders and a separate one for open range production of livestock
workers.
So
you're not challenging the 2007 or 8?
We aren't, because the current 2011 TEAGLs rescinded in full the earlier sets of TEAGLs. So the current ones are the only ones that we could challenge.
Are open range herders different from sheep and goat herders?
I think open range is typically, they're cattle herders.
Oh. So
colloquially, you might call them cowboys or cattle herders.
I see.
And when did your clients in this case, when did they become U.S. workers?
The date of that they became eligible to work in the United States is not in the declarations. They came, I believe, in the early to late 2000s as H-2A workers, but at the time of their declarations, of course, all were legally entitled to work in the U.S. We don't know the date of change.
Because I'm asking because, as you said, these schemes and these exceptions have been in place for a long time, and I'm trying to figure out at least when they had a cause of action that they could have brought to challenge these, an APA action that they could have brought, because they had to transition from H-2A workers to U.S. workers mm-hmm. for purposes of the claim to assert.
I don't know the precise date. I do know at least one of the workers came in the early 2000s, so would have been working potentially under earlier sets of the sheep herding teagles. Of course, the teagle for or special procedures for cattle herders did not come into place until 2007. Some of the workers that came in the later 2000s, I think one of them maybe as late as 2008, although I can check that on rebuttal. So it's a variation in time, but as of the time of their declarations, when the current teagles were in place, all were legally entitled to work.
What do you think is the applicable statute of limitations here?
Well, we are raising an APA claim, so there would be a six-year statute of limitations, which we think runs from the date of issuance of these current teagles in 2011. If I could talk, again, with respect to the nature of plaintiff's injury here, I want to emphasize that their injury is current and continuing under the current teagles. They would return to herding work, which is their preferred occupation. It's their specialty, but for the wages and working conditions that have been allowed under DOL's rules. So I think in this way, the plaintiffs are actually most analogous to plaintiffs in Friends of the Earth v. Laidlaw. The district court focused here on what it saw as our client's conditional intent to return as if that were a problem. But I think as the Supreme Court recognized in Friends of the Earth v. Laidlaw, those plaintiffs there said that they would like to return to a recreational site but for discharge pollutants by the defendants. So there was that sort of conditional nature of that, their intent.
I think the district court here was concerned that you didn't have that but for, because at least in the declarations they said but for wages and the boss that doesn't steal from me. And so they had a couple of other factors identified in their declarations that seemed to qualify whether they would be willing to take these jobs again that arguably at least some of them may have gone beyond anything the teagles would govern.
Well, to the extent that the district court focused on things that should already be required by employers participating in the H-2A program, like, you know, not threatening deportation or not stealing wages, those sorts of things would already be legal.
Is that covered by the teagles? I mean, does notice and comment from the teagles help address? I mean, there's no laws that address stealing wages, but it's not a notice and comment issue under the teagles, is it?
No, it's not, Your Honor. But I think that for purposes of looking at whether my clients would return to herding, I think the fact that they have said we would like the wages and working conditions that notice and comment would provide us, and we would also not like to be treated in ways that are already illegal under current federal law, shouldn't preclude them from having standing to challenge the teagles. The fact that there are abusive workers or abusive employers throughout the herding industry in some cases doesn't mean that my clients don't have standing to challenge the things that the teagles could address, and that DOL at this point permits, separate from legal prohibitions on things, as you mentioned, like wage theft.
Well, if the plaintiffs in Laidlaw had said, I would like to go canoeing again, but for the pollution and the hole in my boat, would they have had standing then?
Well, I think they would have, Your Honor. Certainly, if it is a contributing factor, I guess, is how you could look at it. But I'm not sure that you need to get to that question. For example, Mr. Castro, I believe, in his declaration, talks about the fact that he would like to go back into herding work, his specialty, if he could get a fair wage, like an hourly minimum wage. That is precisely the kind of thing that DOL could address in notice and comment rulemaking. So to the extent that this court thinks that, you know, where our clients said that they would like additional things like time off, again, I think that's something that the teagles could address. If there are things that the teagles do not currently address in our clients' declarations, I don't think that that's the case for all three of them, and certainly only one of them would need to have standing in order for us to be able to continue with the challenge to the rule. I also, turning on the issue of injury, it's irrelevant that the workers here have not formally applied for recent positions. I think the district court placed a lot of emphasis on this, But as DOL's rules state, U.S. workers cannot be expected to accept employment at wages and working conditions that fall below those required by the INA. By the same logic, it would make no sense to ask our clients to go out and apply for jobs and potentially take jobs under the district court's rationale in order to show that they have enough skin in the game that they should be able to challenge the Teagles. I think here our workers have shown that they are able, willing, qualified, and available to do this work, and they would do it but for the wages and working conditions.
How do you distinguish the transportation workers versus TSA case?
I think it's the two cases are different based on the agency action that gives rise to the obligation for the agency to do notice and comment rulemaking. So in transportation workers, of course, the plaintiff in that case was challenging the change between one set of interpretive guidance and another set of interpretive guidance. Here, we're not challenging the switch. We are only looking at what gives rise to the obligation for DOL to do notice and comment rulemaking here is the substantive and legislative nature of the Teagles that were adopted wholesale in 2011. Turning briefly to the issue of causation, if there are no further questions on injury, causation has been challenged here only by the interveners, and we think the Teagles caused the plaintiff's injury because they established substantive and substantively invalid standards. As I said earlier, we don't think it's relevant that the current Teagles, we don't think you have to consider whether the current Teagles are materially identical to earlier sets of Teagles or special procedures, because we think those earlier sets were likewise unlawful, and we're not challenging the switch. So I think in terms of causation...
Then aren't you going to start running into the statute of limitations problem?
I'm sorry?
Aren't you going to start running into the statute of limitations problem that Judge Brown mentioned?
With respect to the 2011 Teagles?
Well, you said don't just focus on how they're different, because unless I misunderstood you, I thought you said you don't need to worry about how they're different or the same because it was carrying forward stuff that was bad before.
I'm saying I don't think you need to worry about how they're different because the agency action that gives rise to DOL's obligation to conduct notice and comment rulemaking here is only the adoption of the 2011 Teagles. Mm-hmm. So it's irrelevant what came before the 2011 Teagles since these current special procedures were adopted wholesale.
The 2011 Teagles have to be the source of your injury.
That's right, and they are. And in that regard...
Don't they have to be different than to cause an injury?
I'm sorry?
Don't they have to be different in some way to cause that injury?
From the earlier Teagles? I don't think so, Your Honor. If that were the case, DOL could insulate its rules forevermore simply by having a proven track record of adopting unlawful rules without notice and comment rulemaking.
Well, I don't think it would be insulation. It would be they would assume someone would have sued them before when they did it without notice and comment rulemaking.
Well, as I said...
This has been here for 50 years. This scheme's been going on, as everyone says, and yet this appears to be the first challenge.
Well, as I said, we're not challenging the change. I think this is distinguishable from a case like transportation workers based on the nature of the agency action. But to your point, Judge Millett, I think even if this court were concerned about differences or similarities with earlier sets of Teagles and a statute of limitations issue, the open-range production of livestock Teagle was first enacted in 2007. And so even if that were in place or had been in place at the time our client sued, there would clearly have been no statute of limitations problem with respect to that. Those special procedures, of course, that was replaced by the current set of Teagles. And so we've challenged the agency action that we are able to challenge given the rescission of earlier sets of special procedures. I see that I'm into my rebuttal time, so if there are no...
Anything else?
Further questions at this time?
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Craig Defoe on behalf of the United States Department of Labor and the Secretary of Labor. I ask that this Court affirm the District Court's ruling that plaintiffs lack standing to maintain this challenge to the 2011 Teagles. The specific problem with standing here is that plaintiffs haven't shown that there's any direct personal connection between their circumstances and these 2011 Teagles at issue in this case. We know that the record shows that each of these plaintiffs left his herding job before these T Kegels took effect in 2001. We know that they haven't worked as herders.
So you said 2001, you mean 2011?
Excuse me, right, 2011. We know that none of the plaintiffs at issue here have worked as herders since the 2011 Kegels took effect. And we know that they haven't been even been actively searching for herding jobs since the Kegels took effect. So,
but isn't that because of their allegation that the wages and working conditions are inadequate? That they say, but for that we would, which is exactly what the plaintiffs said in Friends of the Earth.
They do say that. That is, that's their reason for not apparently actively seeking these jobs. But I don't think that gets them far enough in this situation where they actually remove themselves from the herding job market before the Kegels are challenging.
What about Friends of Earth?
I'm not familiar with the specific facts of that case.
You're not? In Friends of Earth, the plaintiff said, but for the activities of the defendant, the pollution added to the river, they would use the river for recreational purposes if the defendant wasn't using it. They said that was too speculative in the court. And that's what Mendoza says, the same thing. He says, I would be willing to work if it was higher. And the court, I don't see, let me just read you this sentence from Friends of Earth.
Okay.
Nor can Effiant's conditional statement that they would use the nearby river for recreation if defendants were not discharging pollutants into it be equated with the speculative Sunday intentions to visit endangered species halfway around the world we found inadequate in Wuhan. Sounds like this case.
I understand that. I believe this case is actually closer to the situation that the Supreme Court faced in Lujan,
mm-hmm.
where there, as here, we're faced with these generic allegations that plaintiffs would like to get back into this labor market at some time in the future, but they don't provide any specifics as to when that would happen.
Mm-hmm.
How do you define actively seeking? I mean, do they have to be going out for interviews? There's evidence that they are, in fact, monitoring this market, that they're asking people about working conditions and wages.
Well, I think actively seeking could include going out for interviews, actually applying for these jobs. But I don't know that there's...
But couldn't it be less than that? I guess that's what I'm asking. That's a... You know, that's pretty broad, actively seeking. What does that mean?
Well, actively seeking maybe isn't the best language. I think the best language is just the language that the Supreme Court used in Lujan, which is that they need to allege or submit some facts that show that they actually have a concrete intent to take whatever actions they have to take in order to establish that this injury is imminent.
Well, don't they say they would return? They would return to these jobs if the conditions were the ones that they think would be required if you didn't have all these exceptions?
They do say that they would return. I just think that's too speculative under the circumstances of this case.
But Laidlaw says, I would return to go boating is good enough, and they say I would return to herding if the conditions were what they should be had you had some common rulemaking and not made these exceptions.
I understand. I'm not sure, again, as I said, the specific facts of Laidlaw on how they might interact with Lujan, but I believe this case falls under Lujan better. It's worth maybe comparing these facts to two cases that plaintiffs rely on in their brief, such as Shays, which is a case where two congressmen who were actually in Congress and who were fighting re-election battles were challenging the FEC rules that they claimed created additional competition in the campaign marketplace. So in that case, obviously, we can see that the plaintiffs there were actually in the market. There was a direct harm attributable to a direct harm that they were experiencing from this change in the campaign finance marketplace that they were challenging. Likewise, in the Shirley case.
Well, under your theory, what would the plaintiffs have to do to get standing here? What would they have to have done?
Well,
applied for the jobs?
I think if they had applied for jobs, okay, that would likely get them standing.
And suppose the jobs they applied for were at the prevailing rate and they didn't want the job and they said, okay, I've applied, but I'm not going to take it because it's too low. Would you then say they have standing? Or is it your position that they have to actually take the job and work at the lower rate to be able to challenge the department's actions here? Is that your position?
I think that would be a very borderline situation.
What would be a borderline situation?
If they were to actually apply for jobs, have received an offer, and then say, well, this offer isn't good enough, I think that may get them there, but they haven't done that.
But why would that get them there under your theory, since they still have not, all they would be saying is their affidavit would say, I applied for the job, I got it, the prevailing rate is too low, but I would have taken the job if it had been higher and the working conditions had been better. It would be exactly the same case.
Under this hypothetical, they've clearly established a much more concrete desire to re-enter the marketplace, and there's a much more direct connection between the conditions that they allege that these Teagles allow for and what they're claiming is the harm to them. So I think our case is a close case, and that the hypothetical also would be a close case.
Do you know about the futile gesture case law?
Excuse me?
Do you know about futile gesture case law? This court and others, and that is, you know, essentially, if instead of this situation you had an employer that had a sign up that said, jobs inside, no human need apply. And that was 2010, and then 2011 they hung up a new sign that says, more jobs available, no women need apply. Is it your position that a woman would have to apply to have standing to challenge that? Or can they just say it's futile, we see the sign in the window, we get to challenge that?
I'd probably want to know more facts, but...
That's all you've got. That's it. She gets to decide the hypotheticals.
Well, I suppose it's possible. I'm not familiar with that specific legal doctrine. I think it would come back to the ultimate question, which is, did whatever facts they're alleging, whatever actions they've taken, establish that they've actually been injured by the actions that they're challenging. The problem is here, the plaintiffs just hadn't done that. I think, as we sort of discussed in our brief, we believe that there are other groups of plaintiffs that could easily show injury and have standing to challenge these Teagles. It's just the defects here, which include the fact that these plaintiffs left their herding jobs before these 2011 Teagles took effect.
I was curious that you all didn't even challenge standing originally in the district court. So I take it that at some point you first read this complaint and actually thought that, I mean you personally, but that the government read this complaint and thought that there was standing.
I wasn't personally involved at the district court level, so I'm not sure exactly how the decision-making was made at that point. But as I said, we do agree that this is a close case on standing, and so after the district court issued its decision, it forced us to specifically evaluate whether or not we agree with it.
So if we don't agree with you on standing, we think the plaintiffs do have standing, is it, I'm trying to remember, your position, we should remand it to the district court to decide the merits?
The government would not oppose the court reaching the merits here.
So you're okay with us getting to the merits?
Yep. We are.
Okay, fine. Do you want to take 1 or 2 minutes and say something about the merits, just in case we get to it?
Sure. Well, as we discussed in the brief, government maintains that these Teagles are interpretive statements or procedural rules, and therefore they are not required to go through the notice and comment rulemaking process. The plaintiffs focus on their claim that these Teagles have a substantive effect on the parties regulated. And that may be true, but whether or not rulemaking has a substantive effect on a party is irrelevant to whether or not that action is an interpretive statement or a procedural rule here.
Really? What if the substantive effect is, hey, here's a whole series of regulations, but you don't get the benefit of them? Really? That's not substantive enough to require notice and comment?
Well, certainly sometimes when there is a substantive effect, that can ultimately lead to the conclusion that they may be legislative rules, but that's not a determinative.
Okay, so what about this substantive effect, that there's an entire legal regime set up here to protect workers just like you, but this category is going to be carved out of it?
Well, I think if you look specifically at the statute and the actual legislative rules that are in the Code of Federal Regulations here, you see that the Teagles are fully consistent with those, and that they're meant here to address these specific labor markets within the agricultural worker market, which...
What words are you interpreting? Just interpreting.
Well, the Teagles interpret the statutory requirement that the Department of Labor determined that there are not sufficient workers who are able, willing, and qualified and available to perform the labor services at issue, and also that the employment of the H-2A worker will not adversely affect the wages and working conditions of similarly situated United States workers.
So under that theory, would the entire H-2A scheme, all of which is published, regulations right now, that wouldn't have to be published either? Everything that's in the CFR right now would not have to be there because it's just interpreting those exact same words?
That's not the government's position. I wanted to go on and direct the court's attention to the legislative rules that we have here as well, because the legislative rules specifically allow for and contemplate the Department of Labor's issuance of these Teagles. For example, 20 CFR section 655.102 is a section entitled Special Procedures, where this went through notice and comment rulemaking, and the Department of Labor clearly explained its intent to create these special procedures that would address these unique occupations, like herding occupations, where a person...
But those have no meaning without the Teagles. Right? I mean, that doesn't tell us anything about anybody's obligations without the Teagles.
Well, they essentially explain that there will be these exceptions made for these specific parts of the requirements for these specific
Let me ask you about the. Let me just ask you about one specific part, okay? About the housing aspects of it.
Okay.
Section 1188C4 of the statute requires the department to issue regulations governing housing, right?
Yes.
And the regs, Section 122D4, says that housing for sheep herders must meet guidelines issued by the agency.
That's correct.
So the only standards for range housing are in the guidelines. I mean, it sounds awfully legislative to me. It's not. It's the guidelines or the Teagles, I guess, which establish the standards for range housing.
Well, ultimately, when you get down to the specifics, the Teagles are the guidance,
right,
and the interpretation that interprets the housing requirements for the range housing. But the legislative regulations do include a subpart that addresses standards for range housing. It says housing for workers principally engaged in the range production of livestock must meet standards of DOL, OSHA for such housing. So the legislative rules here already, they certainly contemplate and inform the public that the appeals would be forthcoming.
No. Thanks. You're well over your time. Okay, we'll hear from the intervener. Mr. Swan, right?
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Mr. Swan. I represent Appellees Mountain Plains Agricultural Service and Western Range Association. I would invite the court today to focus on a narrow issue of whether these plaintiffs have met their burden of establishing standing in this case. And they have not. Complaint rests on three declarations that offer bare legal conclusions regarding wage suppression, and then factual statements regarding alleged mistreatment at the hands of their former employers. None of these demonstrate that the plaintiffs have suffered an injury in fact with a causal connection.
And how do you distinguish Friends of Earth?
In Friends of Earth, there was a specific site that the plaintiff intended to visit that could be harmed by the challenge agency action. Here, the plaintiffs have not pled with any...
What in Friends of Earth says that the specific... I mean, because they mentioned the river?
Right.
I see.
Right.
You think that's material to the...
I do think that it's material, and I think that it's material in a number of cases.
And why is that different from... They said, we would use the river were it not polluted, and the plaintiffs here say, we would take these jobs where the wage is higher. So one is talking about... the river, the other is talking about the wages. Both of those were the substantive challenge in the case. What's the difference? One's not a place?
A specific place.
One's not a... That's the difference?
That's the difference. Okay. These plaintiffs haven't pointed to any specific jobs or any specific locations where there is wage depression.
Do you know any post-Friends of Earth case that interprets it that way?
I do not, Your Honor.
We don't agree with that. Is there another distinction you want to offer?
Yes, Your Honor.
What is that?
I believe that here the nature of the plaintiff's asserted injury is that the special procedures have had and continue to have an oppressive effect on the labor market. Now, they have not offered any factual statements that support such a broad allegation, which is essentially an allegation.
But on standing, we have to assume that the merits of their claims are correct.
But they're not bringing a claim that the INA was violated. They're bringing a claim that the APA was violated, but they're resting their asserted injury, in fact, on the fact that the INA was violated.
Their argument is that had there been notice and comment, they would have pointed out that that the agency is violating the statute, the INA.
Right, and they're saying that the reason they have an injury is because the agency has been violating the INA. Uh-huh. And they have offered nothing to support that other than bare legal conclusions.
But I'll just say it again. Under standing doctrine, we assume the validity of the merits of the plaintiff's claim and then ask whether, assuming they're correct, do they have standing. So we have to assume, for purposes of this, that notice and comment was required and that they're right that it violates the statute.
I agree that we have to assume that it violates the APA. Uh-huh. I don't agree that we have to assume that the special procedures have and continue to violate the INA.
But we have many cases where plaintiffs are allowed to challenge the absence of notice and comment rulemaking, and we ask whether or not, assuming they're right about that, do they have standing?
Agreed, and I think that in all those cases, we must examine the plaintiff's allegations to see if they describe a legally cognizable injury that is traceable to the challenged agency conduct. Okay. And here, I don't think the plaintiffs have offered sufficient evidentiary support. They have suffered an injury in fact of the nature that they assert, which is that the special procedures have resulted in the DOL violating the INA. Now, I would like to...
If they filed a complaint that said, I would take these jobs if I were offered a lawful wage under the INA, you would agree they have standing?
I would not, Your Honor.
Because?
Because they're... wages are lawful under the Fair Labor Standards Act. It's not the INA that's being violated by not offering a minimum wage. The Fair Labor Standards Act sort of carves out the wage requirements for these workers. So I don't think that it's simply a pleading deficiency that they're bringing the wrong claim. I think that the factual
in these procedural cases, we assume that if the agency had complied with the procedure, then someone could have, the notice and comment would have alerted them to the substantive deficiencies, your substantive deficiency, whatever ones they want to, and then that would have made a difference. And so if we assume that had they been able to go through notice and comment rulemaking, that there would have been comments, and those comments would have brought the agency action into conformance with law, then all they wanted is these regulations to be the same as all the other H-2A regulations.
Right.
Would that be an injury?
They've got a procedural injury. Okay. I don't dispute that there's a procedural injury, but I do dispute that they have failed to allege that they have suffered a substantive injury in fact that's related to that procedural injury, that they have a substantive legal interest that's been affected. They base their assertion that a substantive legal interest has been affected on the fact that wages and working conditions have been depressed as a result of the use of these special procedures. But none of the factual statements in the plaintiff's declarations offer direct evidence that wages have in fact been depressed. They offer conclusory statements that there has been wage depression, but their factual statements related to mistreatment by their employers.
They just have to show the wages for this purpose, that the wages they're getting are different than the wages that they would get even under the regular H-2A, if they weren't carved out from the regular H-2A process. Would that be sufficient if you didn't have this carve-out?
I believe that if the department didn't have statutory authority and hadn't gained regulatory authority through notice and comment to issue special procedures, then you would be correct.
The AWR rate of pay, which applies to everyone else in the H-2A, is exactly the rate of pay that Mr. Cruz and Mr. Mendoza are seeking in their declarations. Why isn't that pretty specific?
I'm sorry, would you please repeat that?
So if you do the math, they say how much they think they get paid a month, and that would be consistent with application of the normal AEWR. If that was applied to these types of goat herding, sheep herding, these were open range workers. It isn't through these regulations, but if it were, they would get the pay they want to take the jobs. That seems fairly specific to me. And it says, if you don't carve us out, you give us the regular H-2A regs, or pay under the AWR, we'll take the jobs. Why isn't that sufficient? Certainly at the 12B6 stage.
I think that at the Rule 12 stage, they still need to demonstrate that they have suffered some sort of injury in fact. Now, we do assume they're procedural injury, but here, as we have to look at what has happened to them as actors in this regulated field. And I don't see anything that's happened to them as actors in this regulated field as a result of the use of special procedures. And that's what I think distinguishes their situation.
Anything else? Thank you.
Thank you.
Did Ms. Murray have any time left? Oh, you can have your minute.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'll be brief. If this Court doesn't have any follow-up questions for me on standing, I'd like to go straight to the merits issues because I didn't address them earlier. The TEGLs are not consistent with the H-2A final rule, as the government has asserted. They, for example, make pay less and less frequent. They do not give herders an entitlement to an AWER, as Judge Millett pointed out. They also, in the case of housing, as Judge Shadle pointed out, supply the only standards on which DOL could evaluate H-2A petitions with respect to herders. DOL was expressly tasked by Congress in Section 1188 with adopting regulations for housing on the open range. It has flagrantly violated that, instead using the TEGLs as a backdoor mechanism to set the only standards available for workers with respect to housing.
What is your response to Mr. Swan's argument that the TEGLs have no connection to the depressed wages and working conditions?
Well, 2 points on that. I heard Mr. Swan's point. He took the position, for example, that the INA doesn't regulate wages at all. And with respect to that issue, I think that's just wrong in the sense that the INA certification standard requires DOL to set wages and working conditions at levels that would not adversely affect similarly employed U.S. workers. The TEGLs here, I think it is one need only look at the difference between the Teagles and the H-2A final rule to see that these Teagles would have a depressive effect on the market. I think it's important to recognize that DOL, in adopting the H-2A final rule, gave its considered judgment that these were the standards necessary to avoid any adverse effect on similarly employed U.S. workers. Nevertheless, through the Teagles, DOL has adopted different standards for herders, and it has never explained why those standards or how those standards could be consistent with its rationale in the H-2A final rule. If this court has no further questions.
Anything else? No.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, thank you both, or all three of you. Case is submitted.